Call them the three R's. There's a reinsurance risk corridor and risk adjustment program, which will mitigate the risk that all the health plans are taking because nobody knows. And that allowed some to play on the exchange that might otherwise have chosen not to, because the degree of damage will be limited. And in Oregon, the Oregon Insurance Division actually added a fourth level to this of risk adjustment to support this effort even further. So Oregon, again, stands out as being kind of unique.
You know, if there was something that I wanted to leave you all with, it's that even with everything you've just listened to, we are so early in the amount of work that has to be done. I don't think any of us are saying, we've got the answer, and if y'all just like climb on our wagon, we're gonna solve this healthcare crisis. This is where we are this year, but we've got a lot of work to do. And I'm hoping that you all will continue to be fighting the good fight, pushing for things to get better. So thank you.
The Health and Healthcare Forum is produced by Roberta Hall and recorded with the aid of Joe Magner of Anabyte Electronics and Recording. Theme music was composed by Laurie Childers and played by Laurie Childers and Kent White.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. The time is 11:31. Up next, the Radio Zine host Ren Green interviews local filmmaker Andy Norris about his new documentary film, Targeting Iran. I'd also like to take this moment to remind you that at 4 p.m. today, there will be an action down at the Federal Building on 3rd and Southwest Madison, called No War in Syria. They will be forming a human chain and letting Congress know that we do not support the war. That is at 4 p.m. at the Federal Building at 3rd and Madison.
Hi, this is Radio Zine. I'm Ren Green, and today I'm talking with Andy Norris, local filmmaker, about his documentary, Targeting Iran, that will be showing at the Clinton Street Theater on Wednesday, September 11th, 2 days from now, at 8 p.m. Hi, Andy.
Hello, Ren. Thanks for having me.
It's really hard for me and a lot of my friends right now to care about foreign policy. It's kind of an intellectual privilege to be able to do so when we're all focused on basic survival. So why do you concern yourself with it?
In Iran, they have the same problem. That's one of the complaints of the pro-democracy movement over there, is that the sanctions that the U.S. is spearheading is really affecting their economy. It's killing the middle class. And since their last uprising, there's a big crackdown, more sanctions. They're still just getting back from where they were 8 years ago. And it's tough.
So how'd you get into this project?
Well, David Barsamian, who wrote Targeting Iran, it's a interview format like a lot of his books. So it has Noam Chomsky, Naheed Mosafari, and some others in it. And he was on a book tour, and he came to Portland. I believe it was an event for KBOO here, because you all carry his show, Alternative Radio. But he was also out in Astoria, and I live out at the coast. And so I went to go see him, and I was just really taken by the perspectives that he offered and his interviewees offered in the book. And it just seemed like a timely thing. And sure enough, you know, it is. I don't think it takes much genius to figure out that Iran is in the crosshairs. They have been for quite some time now. I don't want to see another war. And that's what was behind this, you know, just add to that inertia to keep the troops and bombs and all everything else out of Iran.
What did David Barsamian say when you approached him about the project?
So I talked to David, and I told him I wanted to make a film about the book, and he was all about it, and he's been very helpful. He was instrumental in getting Noam Chomsky to talk to us for the film, so that was great. He's very happy about it, and he's happy with the result.
So he felt that you interpreted his material in a way
that
really works.
And you know, we went a little wider with it. You know, we talked to Stephen Kinzer, Vandana Shiva, Jim Walsh, who is just a brilliant MIT guy who works on nuclear issues and goes to Iran and talks to their nuclear folks over there. Trita Parsi. You know, he wasn't in David's book, but he's in the film, and he runs the National Iranian American Council in D.C. They're leading the charge to debunk a lot of this propaganda that we're seeing in the mainstream media. The same kind of stuff we saw in the lead up to Iraq. You can see it happening with Iran. And so he's on top of that. It was great to get him involved. Nazila Fati, she's a research fellow at Harvard. She's writing a book, and she grew up during the Iran-Iraq war. When Iraq invaded Iran, Iran did not invade Iraq. Iraq invaded Iran, and Donald Rumsfeld went over and shook Saddam's hand. I think a lot of folks saw a video of that in Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11. So we provided satellite photos and helicopters to Saddam. Now, ironically, some of that very satellite intelligence was used by Saddam to use chemical weapons on the Iranian troops. That would not have been possible without our helicopters and our intelligence. So there's a bit of hypocrisy going on now when we're looking to go into Syria because they use chemical weapons when we supported Saddam in his effort to do the same to the Iranians. And I'd like to point out, too, that Iran did not respond with chemical weapons. The leadership, you know, despite their failings in human rights abuses, they feel chemical weapons are haram, irreligious. So they did not respond with chemical weapons.
And that is, in fact, an official designation from the top of their government that they will not use these things because it belies their faith.
Yeah, I mean, that's the conjecture. I guess, you know, a fatwa may have been issued. I'm not sure. I mean, I haven't seen this documentation, but they did not respond with chemical weapons, and they certainly could have. They possessed them at the time. They probably still do. And that's a good thing. I think that says a lot about them as a country. And they haven't invaded another country in 250 years. I mean, the last 60 years alone, you know, we've been Korea and Iraq and Kosovo, just all over the place doing all sorts of damage, Vietnam and Iran. They haven't invaded anyone in 250 years.
Let's look at the history of Iran just for a few minutes. Now, in the film, you make the point that their culture has been around in some format for 5,000 years, and they're the first formal civilization that humankind built. In the 19th century, Russia and England were duking it out over Iran, and then as they were beginning to develop their own democracy, the U.S. interfered because of oil in 1953. The CIA and the MI6 went into Iran, overthrew their government, and then we got the Shah.
Yeah, absolutely. And Stephen Kinzer speaks on that quite well in the film, The Overthrow of Mossadegh. He wrote a book, All the Shah's Men, that details that. Just this last week, this was the anniversary of that overthrow, the U.S.-sponsored coup, and the CIA finally officially admitted that they overthrew Mossadegh. But Mossadegh was a secular liberal. Iran, you know, they've had a constitution for 100 years. You know, elections aren't always fair. They're not always fair here either. And they're figuring it out. And really, the way to help them move towards democracy is to support the middle class, get rid of the sanctions, and let the people there do it. I mean, you're not going to bomb them to democracy. It doesn't work. Iraq's in shambles. It's worse off than when we showed up. Afghanistan's in shambles. Bombing for democracy doesn't work, and kind of boggles the mind that some folks continue to go down that road.
Well, and it's because of our interference in 1953, that set them down the path that eventually got them to where they are now, with this kind of oppressive theocratic regime that we're even less happy with than before.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
we outright
talk about blowback.
Yeah, we outright interfered in their democracy. These people have a reason to be pissed.
Absolutely. Another ironic thing is the people aren't angry with the American people. They're very pro-American in Iran, and I haven't been over there myself, but I've gotten that, you know, firsthand accounts, and Rick Steves, who I should point out, gave us a lot of footage to use for free. He went over to Iran and talked to a lot of the folks and found a lot. Just the pro-American sentiment was remarkable, considering all we've done to them over the years.
They're a lot like us.
Oh yeah, I mean, they're just Rick Steves is on the corner, and you know, people surround him, and they're just all happy and excited, and you know, you see this footage. That's not in the film. Rick isn't in the film, but you know, just looking through his footage, you know, I saw a lot of that. So yeah, it's remarkable. It's the usual thing, you know, the leaders want war, the people don't. It's the age old story. So in this particular case, I think for those of us who don't want war, we need to look at Iran, you know, do they pose an existential threat to us or Israel? I don't believe so whatsoever. Would they use a nuclear weapon? You know, that would be the instant liquidation of their country. They're not that stupid. And so there's a lot of things that, you know, I think we need to wrap our minds around. And right now it's critical because Iran and Syria have a mutual defense agreement. Congress is voting today, I believe, perhaps it's already happened, whether or not to authorize an attack on Syria. Well, that very easily could spin into an attack on Iran and who knows what. And it's a tough situation. And it might, you know, some of this might even, the Syria stuff might be really just a backdoor into Iran. It's an issue that I think folks really should try and wrap their minds around at this point, because we are hitting another critical spot. The war machine's revving up.
And once again, it's over oil and natural gas.
You know, and maybe some other strategic stuff as well. You know, the nuclear thing may be sort of a ruse, whether, you know, the Iran is not, the position of the U.S. intelligence agencies at this point is Iran is not pursuing a nuclear weapon. They do not have a weapons program.
One of your interviews made the point that that Iran in the past 50 years has experienced three different types of government: military might, religious rule, and then this secular democracy that we disrupted in the early 50s. And one of the interviewer made the very excellent point that it's not the Iranian people's job to come up with a government that appeals to the United States.
Yeah, and that was Stephen Kinzer talking about that in the film. Yeah, you know, and that's very true. And we certainly seem to like to spread our style of democracy around the world. You know, it's got to be how we like it. But there's different cultures, and they're not all going to respond well to that.
David Barsamian did a lecture in Seattle in support of the book. And he made the point about Eisenhower's last speech on the military-industrial complex. That seems really disingenuous, considering that he helped create it. And one of his early actions was that CIA coup in Iran. So we keep making the same mistakes over and over and over. And I'm wondering at what point the rest of the world is going to say, okay, you know what? What you're doing doesn't work. And you want us to come down this path again. Do you think we're getting close to that place? Because if I could ask one thing of our world leaders, I'd say, stop enabling my government.
Well, first of all, that Eisenhower quote, when I do, you know, that his warning, his final farewell address, we warned about the rise of the military-industrial complex. I do see the sort of hypocrisy in that, seeing as he was, a key figure in the overthrow of Mossadegh and escalating the sort of fascistic military element of our society here. But, you know, people change. Maybe by the end he realized he made a mistake or something, and, you know, who knows.
It was his Oppenheimer moment.
Right. And so, yeah, you know, as Obama's going around trying to get international support to bomb Syria, you know, Britain, they're not going along. Their people spoke out. There's been some protests in the States, not too much. And, you know, I think maybe the world is kind of getting sick of us being the bullies and running around spreading so-called democracy. But that kind of thing, it might just run its course. It might just, if we're not taking care of the country at home, or, you know, if our infrastructure is falling apart, which it is, and people are you know, don't have health care and can't find work, you're not going to have a strong country anymore. So it might just take care of itself that way.
And several of your interviewers made the point that spreading democracy at gunpoint actually has the opposite effect.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look at, you know, all these drone bombings in Yemen and Pakistan. I mean, everything that comes out of there just indicates that it's spreading anti-Americanism. It's not bringing democracy. The drones aren't making people's lives better. It's creating a rally around the flag effect, essentially, in Yemen and Pakistan. And it's spreading extremism. And they're getting new recruits. And for the war makers, maybe that's part of their objective. You know, some people do want war. It's unfortunate, but it's big money. And a lot of people do want war. And so that could be behind some of that stuff. But, you know, I sure hope that the Syria vote fails in the House, and that, which it looks like it will. We'll see. It looks like it's nowhere near passing, actually, last time I checked. But and then what will Obama do at that point? I don't know. We'll have to see. I'm hoping that he would follow the leader of leadership in Britain and opt not to go in. Listen to the people, you know, because that's what the House is doing. They're looking at their constituents. They're getting emails. I think DeFazio was it was on Democracy Now, actually, which is carried on KABU and covering Syria very well. DeFazio was, I think he got like 1,200 don't bomb Syria emails and 18 bomb Syria emails. And it's a similar thing across the country. The American people don't want this war. Why Obama is going after it, it's a mystery. I can only guess. But hopefully it's not going to happen. Well, I guess we'll know later today.
Here's a little clip from the film.
Iran is completely surrounded by U.S. forces, naval armadas. The U.S. has complete control of the skies. It has satellite monitoring devices. So if the U.S. were to launch, or its ally, Israel, which is a proxy for the U.S., were to launch any kind of military action on Iran, the consequences would be enormous, and they could quickly spin out of control. Iran probably has the second largest reserves of natural gas and oil in the world. Certainly, it's a major factor. If all they had were grapes and pomegranates, it would not be as obsessional as it is for Washington.
And I think oil and gas wars are so wrong, because they're not just wars against a country that controls the oil and gas. They end up being wars against the planet, because when you keep pushing this oil addiction, you are pushing climate change and climate havoc.
But this goes back to the question of survival again. I mean, if nuclear weapons remain, sooner or later they're going to be used in a manner that's massively destructive.
Nothing is inevitable.
You're listening to Radio Zine. I'm Ren Green. I'm talking to Andy Norris, local filmmaker and creator of the documentary Targeting Iran, which will be at the Clinton Street Theater on Wednesday night, September 11th at 8 p.m. Will you be there?
I will be there, and I'll be doing a Q&A afterwards. And yeah, please, everyone remotely interested in this, I urge you to come down and see what these folks have said on this issue. Some real smart people saying some smart words at the right time. Can I plug a film right before? This is at 8 o'clock, Targeting Iran. At 6 o'clock, I'll be showing Source to See, the Columbia River Swim, and that's about Christopher Swain's swim for clean water and human rights down the entire Columbia River. And that film deals a lot with tribes, salmon, Hanford, that kind of thing. And won a bunch of awards on the festival circuit, and it premiered at Clinton Street a few years ago, and we're showing it again. So.
Oh, great. So what got you into documentary filmmaking?
Failing at feature filmmaking, pretty much. I lived in L.A. and New York and worked crews on different motion pictures. And it was really, I guess, when I found out that Christopher was swimming the Columbia, no one was making a film about it. Fit that opportunity fell into my lap. So that was the first one I made. And, the drive is to make the world a better place, that kind of thing, you know. And right now, docs are all over. People are liking it. And the technology is making it very accessible. Just my way to do my part.
Was it a huge transition to go from feature fiction to documentary?
Well, no. I mean, it's different worlds. I mean, I was just crew doing crew stuff, so I didn't really have creative input. I mean, so it's kind of like apples and oranges, but it was different. Didn't really require much of a transition, I'd say.
Are you working on anything particular right now?
Fukushima thing. Yeah, I feel like I'm chronicling the demise of our planet or something.
Yeah, we are.
Columbia River, Fukushima. But Fukushima's it's out of control. It's getting hotter and hotter. It's nowhere near done. I think we're going to be hearing a lot more about that in the years to come. And there honestly is the potential to kill the Pacific there, and it's scary.
Our evening news director actually mentioned the other day that it might be a good idea if we started doing a daily Fukushima update. This stuff is washing up on our shores. It's serious.
It is.
And
it
we
is.
Can't eat the fish.
NOAA is testing for radioactivity in tuna now up in Washington. Canada is worried about their fishery collapsing. Radiation's shown up from Fukushima in Monterey Bay and the seaweed. So, yeah, it's already hit over here. It's not looking to get better. I mean, they're putting 600 tons of radioactive water a day into the Pacific right now. And that's been going on for 2 years. And it's still heating up. It's not done. That's the other thing. And yeah, it's scary. I don't like thinking about it, but I have to. And I live mostly at the coast, so I'm, you know, walk on the beach and, you know, what's blowing over, you know? I find tsunami debris and I should get a Geiger counter.
So it's relevant and immediate in your life.
Oh, yeah.
Targeting Iran has a little financing story. Did you make it out of your pocket? How did you
get
this film?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. It took, you know, it was a long time from when I talked to David and the film was made. Once the money showed up, it took 5 months, you know, and that included a trip to the East Coast to talk to all the folks in the film. And but it took a while to get the money, and I tried the crowdfunding, Indiegogo and Kickstarter. I don't know. I have a few projects. I can't remember. But I didn't meet the goal. And so I sent a letter out to everyone who had contributed saying, hey, we're not making the film, didn't meet the goal. Well, then I got a response from one of them, and it was a gentleman in Australia. And this issue is very passionate to him. He has Middle Eastern descent. And he said, I'm just a regular guy with a lot of disposable capital at the moment. I'm into politics and film, and the Iran thing is passionate in my life, and I want to finance the whole thing. So, boom. And so that was great. That made the film. So even though the crowdfunding didn't hit the goal, you know, you can go off-site with if you meet the right folks and get things done that way. Yeah, I encourage that for any creative folks, from painters to filmmakers, whatever. It's a lot of good stuff done with the crowdfunding these days.
How much footage did you get? Your final is 68 minutes. What were you chopping down from?
Oh, you know, I think we talked to everyone for about an hour. There's nine people in the film, so it's probably something like that. And then again, the footage from Rick Steves, and he's just a great guy. I think he gave $1 million to the legalized marijuana effort up in Washington.
Oh, go Rick.
Yeah, and so I had heard that, and so I figured he was a pretty cool guy. And I drove up there to his office in Edmonds and showed him the demo we had. And I was like, you know, it was an anti-war film about Iran, and, you know, you were just over there, your footage is great, can I use some? I don't have any money. And he said, yeah, sure, you can use it.
Oh.
So that was good. That was great. So thanks, Rick. You know, that was key. His footage is beautiful. I mean, you don't see much contemporary footage of Iran and the people. We just don't see it here, you know. And so there's a lot of that in there. So then that was about an hour. So probably 10 hours to make an hour. Not bad. Columbia River film was, I don't even know, 100 hours for an hour and a half.
Which of these interviews was the most surprising or startling, or which did you enjoy most as an interviewer?
Oh, boy. I mean, you know, I felt the most professional and accomplished interviewing Chomsky. But I only got to talk to him for about a half an hour. Jim Walsh, you know, the nuclear stuff is interesting to me because it's a lot of, we see it with respect to Iran. We just hear nuclear program, nuclear, and everyone just thinks bomb, bomb, they want a bomb, the crazy Islamists want to nuke us. And it couldn't be further from the truth. So hearing Jim talk about the technical aspects and simplifying it and where the Iranian nuclear program is and what they will need to do from a scientific standpoint to have a deliverable nuclear device. So that was fascinating for me because they're really far away. And so just hearing that process and coming to that conclusion was pretty eye-opening. I enjoyed talking to Trita Parsi as well, just because he's there on K Street in D.C. and just super busy doing lots of great work. And just what a courageous guy to be, I don't know how old, maybe 40 or something, and he is just in the thick of it in the power center of the U.S. that's trying to, you know, make things happen, militarize the Middle East, and he's fighting it and fighting the good fight. And he's endured lawsuits and slander and all sorts of stuff. So it was a treat interviewing him just because he's very courageous, brave individual, I think, for doing what he's doing in Washington.
You just mentioned Iran's nuclear program, and once again, who encouraged them to develop a nuclear power program?
Yeah, that's an interesting story. That was
it was us.
Yeah, it was the United States. Went to the Shah and said, "Hey, we want you to build some nuclear power plants." So we started Iran's nuclear a program.
So that they could sell more oil to the world.
Right. So they could sell, then the idea being that they could then have their own electricity and it'd be in their economic advantage to sell the oil instead of burn it for electricity. That was the argument we made to them, you know. And so here we are 30, 40 years later. And now we don't want them to have that same nuclear program anymore. You know, now they can't have it.
I'm 43, and I was living in France at the time of the Iranian hostage crisis, and my father worked for the embassy, and there were embassy bombings all over the place. It was really scary. And this was actually the first international foreign affairs crisis that I ever became aware of in my childhood.
Yeah.
And I think for a lot of people my generation, those images from the embassy and the blindfolds.
For a lot of people in America, that's where the Iran stops. Like, you know,
yeah.
Anything after that doesn't matter. They're just, you know, that's their memory and their perception of Iran. And that's all, you know, and the reason why that embassy was stormed was because Carter gave sanctuary to the Shah. He had came out with cancer and they flew him over to the United States and for treatment in New York, I think. And the Iranians were not happy with that. They wanted to try him for war crimes, crimes against humanity. And that's why they stormed the embassy. Then once they stormed the embassy, they uncovered proof that the CIA had overthrown Mossadegh, that had always been speculated. But now they had the proof. So that didn't help the situation either. So that's how that all came about. And boy, have the war makers used that as a reason for further bloodshed, you know. And again, you know, and that's not, it's not nice to take hostages. It's, you know, that's not nice behavior. But you have to understand the context and why that went about. And don't forget what we have done to the world. You know, it's easy for us to point a finger, you know. Assad uses chemical weapons. Well, you know, while we've destroyed Iraq, I mean, it's not even close. It doesn't compare. Whatever the numbers are, and they're varying from 200 to 1,200 on the number of dead in Syria. Whether or not Assad did that is a whole other question.
One of the points your film also makes is the role that the media can play in jacking up American anti-Middle East sentiment, whether we're talking about Iran or Syria or whoever at this point. And you made the example of the Associated Press releasing what was a diagram from a nuclear engineering textbook to some sort of documented proof that Iran was developing weapons. And my question is, what is the AP's skin in that game? Why would our media be complicit in this?
You know, I don't know too much about the AP and the powers behind them. So I'm not sure what their reasoning would be for publishing something so obviously false as that particular graph. Obviously, I can't show it to the listeners. But it's a very simple graph that can be found in nuclear engineering textbooks. And it was released by the Israelis as proof that Iran was trying to pursue a nuclear weapon. I saw the graph in the article in The Oregonian, drinking coffee. And I read it, and I saw it as propaganda. And then 2 days later, I saw the retraction, which I thought was very interesting. And then I show up a month later and talk to Trita Parsi, who's in the film. He talks about this in Targeting Iran in the film. And Trita's the one who killed it and put out the word to lots of folks who then talked to the AP and pressured them to do a retraction on it. So that was an interesting story, just to see it all happen in front of me. You know, I mean, what about the Oregonian? Why is the Oregonian printing that? You know, it's but it'll go on and on. And it's tough, you know. I mean, people, you know, in this case, war makers who want more military action in the Middle East, they have an objective and they will lie, cheat, and steal to get it done. And certainly unnamed sources, Pentagon officials are feeding this stuff, and no one knows who this information is really coming from, you know, and I think that's critical in journalism. And certainly, you know, the Oregonian, the AP didn't check in that case.
This is Radio Zine. I'm Ren Green, and I've been talking to Andy Norris, local filmmaker, about his documentary, Targeting Iran. And once again, where will you be screening this on Wednesday?
Clinton Street Theater, 9/11, 8 p.m., preceded by Source to See the Columbia River Swim at 6 p.m.
Thank you for coming in, Andy.
Hey, thanks, Ren.
Taking you to faraway places and bringing them home to you. Cha-cha-cha. It's the Tiki Cha-Cha Club, KBOO's all-vinyl guilty pleasure. Monday nights, midnight to 1 a.m. on 90.7 FM stereo and around the world at KBOO.FM.
Hi, this is Ren Green with the latest episode of my K-Boo podcast, Experience Points. This week, I talk with bipolar peer support specialist Gina Wheeler about mental illness and peer counseling.
I just want everybody that has a mental illness to know that there is more out there than just that medical model, that there's hope, there's help, there's support, and tapping into that community, you can really find how to live your life and not just survive.
To hear the whole interview, go to kboo.fm and search for Bipolar DBT Peer Counseling Oh My.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or grendelscoffee.com.
Good afternoon. You're listening to the Noontime Jamboree. I'm Allie Starr. I'm filling in for Mighty Hawk. I'm going to play mostly vinyl today, so settle on in and let's listen to one from Don Gibson.
Low and lonely, sad and blue. Thinking only little you. I'm always trying to keep from crying. I'm a low and lonely over you. Well, now do you miss me? Say you do. Tell me, darling, please tell me true.